Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. This week, we're joined by Liz Krueger. She is a Democrat from the east side of Manhattan, the 28th District. And it's always a pleasure to sit down and have a serious conversation about the issues of New York State. Welcome back to the Capital Connection, Senator Krueger.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here with you.
And with you, of course, a $237 billion budget passed. I know the media, we make a big deal out of it, not making it by the budget deadline of April 1st. Nonetheless, the plan includes restored funding for school aid and a package to encourage the growth of affordable housing. Even the State University of New York received its largest funding increase in 50 years, a $114 million operating increase on top of last year's $163 million increase. Those are a couple of the highlights. Senator Krueger, let's start with what you like about what's in this budget.
Well, I think you covered some of it. I mean, we did increase funds for CUNY and SUNY, not perhaps as much as they had hoped, but significantly. We tried to address the crisis of the hospitals on the three SUNY campuses, all of which were on the verge of collapse. So we helped them. We still have to figure out what's going to happen with Stony Brook downstate in Brooklyn, but we reversed the governor's proposal to just close them. We passed a housing bill that has things to love and hate, and we've been hearing from people about both sides of that. We knew that we needed to increase the pace at which we were building housing throughout New York State, but how much of it was going to be affordable, we don't feel like we got far enough, but further than the governor had proposed. We also built in a good cause eviction bill, which many activists and renters have been hoping for years. It is a much weaker version than we, the Senate Democrats, proposed. So again, good news, bad news, but we felt that we had to get started.
Senator Krueger, do you think upstate communities will opt in? I know there's an opt-in for upstate, right?
There's an opt-in because there were communities who hated the idea and communities who loved the idea. There were several who had tried to pass it at the local level, and the court said you don't have the authority to create this on your own. So I think that places like Albany and Rochester and Syracuse and Buffalo will give this a very hard look, and I think several of them will opt in. There are even some smaller rural communities who have talked about the advantages for themselves. So we'll have to see. Certainly, there were advocates who felt we should do it as an opt-out instead and have everybody go in and then make the decision to pull out. But that was, frankly, too controversial to get across the finish line. So we went with the opt-in model, except for New York City, where it's required. There's lots and lots of pieces of the housing issues. So I almost don't want to use up all my time for that. The governor had proposed enormous cuts in K through 12 education, and we actually almost half the districts in the state would have taken cuts under her proposal. We reversed that. There is no district getting less than they got last year, although some would argue they should have gotten a lot more, but we're very happy we were able to reverse those cuts. We made some significant changes in healthcare financing, and again, some people will be happy. Some people will say not enough. We did not resolve the very complex issue of home care and the cost of it overall and the need to increase the payments for home care workers so that we get more people even willing to want to do this work. You know, transportation, we put some significant money into both upstate mass transit and, of course, trying to assure that we keep our MTA moving forward at a stable level after so many years of hits from the pandemic, less ridership, massive storms doing so much damage. I guess that's the other theme that we have to confront in every state budget from now on. Climate change is wreaking havoc on our natural environment and our structured environment. And we, the state, have to make sure we have adequate funds to provide the remediation when things go wrong and models for sustainability as we continue fight the fight to decrease the rate at which climate change is moving forward. I am disappointed that a number of my key points of legislation did not move through in the budget, the New York HEAT Act.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's get into that a little bit. First of all, why didn't it pass?
There are certain companies who are in the gas and oil business who've been doing a very good job of providing misinformation and false education to constituents and elected officials. And unfortunately, we're successful in convincing enough of them that if we move forward with the New York HEAT Act, somebody's going to come turn off the gas in your home tomorrow without your permission, which is absolutely not true. Basically, the HEAT Act says, let's stop forcing the building of new gas pipes into every new building that is built in New York State. In fact, we have the all-electric bill and the CLCPA law already in law saying we can't be doing that. And yet, until we pass the New York HEAT Act, it is still on the books in New York State that anytime somebody builds something new, they must build an extra 100-foot connection from a major gas pipe into the building. That's costing ratepayers over $200 million a year to add additional gas pipe infrastructure when it's illegal, basically, to use the new system and to continue to pay to update and keep our entire gas system functioning when we're not supposed to be using it by like 2030, 2040 at the latest. So why are we keep pouring billions of dollars into repairing and upgrading? So in the New York HEAT Act, it's no, you don't have to put in the last 100 feet unless there's some reason that building really needs gas, perhaps some kind of manufacturing, in which case they can ask the Public Service Commission for an exemption.
I heard one organization that's advocating for the HEAT Act blame it basically on a gas distributor out of Western New York. But I'm wondering if it gets down to the fact that a lot of these companies have money to lobby with, whereas a lot of the nonprofits fighting for the HEAT Act may not have the same ammunition, so to speak. They just have the power of their words.
Yes, the people are on our side, but we are outgunned by the amount of money being used to lobby to push back against everything we're trying to do on climate change and to address something that I think most everyone knows. We don't have any time to waste. The weather, look at weather reports every day of your life. The number of storms, the damage that is done by the storms, the rising water tables in our oceans and along our, particularly our beachfront areas. I mean, Long Island is losing its beachfront and literally its land every day because of the increased ocean levels. There's just so much evidence that there is so much going wrong, and we can be doing far more to slow down those changes and hopefully ultimately take action to reverse them as the technology gets better and better.
Well, I'm guessing since the speaker, Carl Hastie, and the assembly where the HEAT Act stopped, who was quoted yesterday as saying it's not necessarily not going to be passed. So do you have hope that through further negotiation, this could actually pass?
Yes, I always have hope. Otherwise, I wouldn't do the job I do. And he is correct. We still have time during the remainder of this session to pass the bill in both houses. We've passed it in the Senate, but if the Assembly has specific modifications that we think are, in fact, reasonable, I am more than happy to work with them on making changes. Pat Fahey, who's the sponsor of the bill in the Assembly, has been a terrific partner here. I know she wants to get this passed. So, yeah, not getting it in the budget doesn't mean it doesn't get done.
Let's talk about education and hold harmless. Now, that was a big sticking point. The governor wanted to remove that provision, which would have taken away the ability of all school districts to get a raise, in fact, for each year's budget. However, it still hasn't solved how we fund the schools equitably, right?
Correct. And so we, for several years, have been urging the state to commission a study to evaluate the base formula of how we calculate education funding to each district. And up until this year, the governor fought us on that and would not support the creation of such a commission. In this year's budget, happily, we do have an agreement to get this done, and to get it done, I believe, by the end of this year, so that when we go into next year's budget discussions, hopefully we will have a new model for formulas to calculate what school districts need. That doesn't mean we're going to be able to give them everything they want, but I think it's really important to understand that the formula we have been working off of, I think, is from before 2007. A lot of things have changed since then. The percentage of non-English speakers who come into our schools in certain areas has changed dramatically. The mental illness issues for children have changed dramatically. Where we're getting our teachers from and how they're getting the skill sets they need to work in our schools has changed dramatically. And so we think, and we've been making this position clear for several years, the Senate Democrats, that we need experts to come in and evaluate how we take the pot of money for schools and distribute it in a rational way that addresses the actual needs of the school districts. Some school districts have lost a lot of children. No doubt about it. Some have grown. When you're in rural New York State, even if your school districts have been losing children, the geography of distance between schools is so enormous that to simply say, you know, well, send your kids on to a school that's further away, where the school that's further away might be an hour and a half, you know, is not a realistic analysis. But then when you look at urban areas, the number of children coming into our schools who don't speak or read English, even if they're coming in, you know, later than the first couple of grades, has grown significantly, not just in New York City, but around the state. We need to factor that in. We need to factor in the impact of technology and education, because nobody was talking about using technology to help in education, you know, 35 years ago. I know people who are very young don't believe that's true, but remember how computers were so exciting, we didn't know what they were?
Now, we both remember before there were computers.
I remember doing my master's thesis on an electric typewriter, thinking I was going to kill myself.
I did mine as well. I mean, I took senior typing on those old clunky typewriters.
Exactly. And carbon paper, because there were no such things as copyright.
No question.
Carbon paper. And electric typewriters, oh my goodness.
Students of mine would look at me like I had three heads if I said, get the carbon paper.
Exactly. But, you know, there's just so many changes in how we should be educating our children and what skills they need and what the best models are, that of course we should be taking a hard look and asking questions. So hopefully this commission will be working with the regions, with stakeholders. I believe it will be coordinated through the Rockefeller Institute, which is the policy institute for SUNY. And let's see if we can actually come up with a better, more equitable formula for education funding starting in next year's budget.
All right, now let's go to an issue that has ruffled many feathers, especially on the Republican side of the aisle in New York, and that's the issue of migrants. Immigrants, they've been sent all over the country by Republican governors to Democratic states. We've seen that happening. And the state of New York, specifically New York City, has had trouble dealing with the influx of migrants. I believe the governor included, what, $4 billion in the budget to deal with migrants? But of course, this all really hinges on what the federal government does, doesn't it?
Of course it does. Actually, we put $2.4
billion
in for migrants from the state budget. I think the mayor was projecting, you know, more than $5 billion expense for the city, although he keeps changing his numbers, so I'm not sure what they are now. And yes, my Republican colleagues were extremely critical over and over and over again of New York City specifically, as if we caused all these problems. But of course, immigration policy is exclusively federal territory, and migrants have always come into this country in search of more opportunities for themselves and their families and safety from wherever they're fleeing. Because usually they are fleeing a dangerous situation for themselves and their families. And they come to America in hopes of a better life, because that's exactly what my grandparents did. And pretty much everybody's grandparents or great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents. That is the history of this country. And really the history of New York State. So I'm quite aggravated that somehow my Republican colleagues think this is only an issue for Democrats. This is only an issue because the New York City, this is a issue for the country. And when people come to the state, it's an issue for the entire state.
And it's not nuanced, right? It's never nuanced in the idea that asylum seekers, they're not here illegally. They're not illegal immigrants.
Well, they continue to argue that that wasn't correct. They kept talking about them as illegals. We kept trying to clarify what the definition is of a migrant or an asylee, and that one of the top goals of the city of New York when they arrive is to start the process of paperwork so that they can move through a process at the federal level that will hopefully allow them to get working papers and even start their process into legalization or, if the federal government determines, deportation. But really, a top priority for all of us should be helping people get their working papers, because guess what? We have jobs that need workers all over the state. There's been research done showing we can't absorb these people successfully into our economy, but only if we can get them the paperwork so that they can be hired legally. And then what does the research shows? When people come here from wherever, whenever, and they're actually allowed to work legally, they absorb into our economy quite quickly, and they become taxpayers and good citizens. And even upstate Republican cities have had enormous success having migrant populations come and repopulate their underpopulated cities and start up new models of economies. And, you know, it's politics in a brutal format of somehow they were describing them all as criminals, not true. Describing them all as having no reason to be here, not true. Causing chaos, not true. It is true that there's a lot of migrants coming all at once to the city of New York, and it has been a bit overwhelming, particularly because, of course, we have a housing shortage,
right,
particularly affordable housing. And so it would be great if the rest of the state took on their responsibility for a share of the burden as well. And some are, but not nearly enough. I wish the governor would speak out more about that and help coordinate more of that. I was even reading on the floor of the Senate the descriptions of how New York State was one of the only states in the country ever to pass a law to deport immigrants. And that were the Irish in 1850. And the Irish were described as dirty and dangerous and stupid and should not be allowed to continue to enter our country or our state. It was so disturbing. And then, of course, in the 1920, the federal government outlawed Italians from entering this country because, quote unquote, they were all criminals. And, of course, earlier still, we had the federal government cut off populations from China coming because we thought there were too many of them. You know, you would think we would learn our lessons in this country based on our own history. And yet the hostility was so extreme and so out of proportion to what the reality is.
Well, let's talk about a first in this legislative session. New York has become the first state in the nation to incentivize hiring and retaining local journalists. Yes, you can see my my bias here. Similar to a federal proposal stalled in Congress, the Empire State has enacted a proposal that will provide local news outlets, including local radio and TV stations, with a payroll tax credit to incentivize media outlets to hire more reporters. There's some details in here, including it's a $5,000 tax credit for each full-time employee hired, up to a maximum of $20,000. It's based on net new jobs created, so a newsroom can't just lay off a whole team and then hire one new reporter to get the credit. However, it does speak to this problem we're facing in journalism right now, which is because of the internet, your mainstream journalism, television and radio, and especially newspapers, have lost a lot of that pay model advertising that used to work for them. So now we see the effort in New York and even on the federal level, which is stalled, to try to help journalism, obviously the Fourth Estate, and in the Bill of Rights, that you can't have a democratic society without a healthy press.
You're absolutely right, and I'm really proud that we got that done literally at the last minute, and it is a recognition that we do not want to lose our local journalism because it's so key to democracy and information flow in our society. But also, we define a million different things as good for the economy that we offer assistance to through our tax system. Why not do the same for this crucial part of our society as well as our economy, media and access to news?
Senator Liz Krueger, my last question here has to do with the current situation on college campuses across the country, including right there in Manhattan at places like Columbia and Connecticut at Yale, and the protests that are going on as a result of the Israel-Hamas war. Now, as a progressive leader, as someone who's Jewish, you know, one of the things that it seems to me gets lost in this whole issue is nuance, that maybe it's not one or the other, but that we want people to stay alive, not go hungry, and we want others to not use terrorism to make their point.
It's such a difficult and painful issue. And depending on who you talk to, you get completely different answers. So why they're doing what they're doing and what is actually happening. I'm not one who believes we should be firing every college president, and I'm not one who believes we should be throwing every student out of school because they protest some policies either of the school or of U.S. government. And yet I also see and hear, even from my own family members who are still on college campuses, the fear that sometimes comes through with threats of violence. You know, and some of it you just go, really? For example, I think Columbia, probably NYU also has groups, Queers for Hamas. But just for the record, if you're queer, Hamas is going to kill you within the first 5 seconds. So I don't really understand the correlation between the support. But you're seeing people coming from every imaginable perspective on this. And of course, college students, by definition, have been outspoken protesters of different issues in this country, certainly my whole life, and I think longer than that. But it doesn't change the fact that the strife, it's become impossible in some places for students to feel safe going to classes, for faculty to feel safe teaching. We can't forget the fundamental right to freedom of speech and academic independence. I feel very strongly about that. My cousin's a retired college professor, but I know when I was speaking at my family Seder a couple of nights ago, I was asked to say something because there was so much tension, frankly, between different people in the same family in the Jewish community.
Yeah.
That I asked everybody to remember that the fundamental teaching of Judaism is peace, moving the world forward together, the inherent dignity of every human being, recognizing that the nightmare going on in Israel and Gaza has caused enormous pain to all members of our community and other communities in the Palestinian community, that we must play a role to fight for human rights in the world and to mourn the loss of the thousands killed and kidnapped, even in a time of war. And it's just so hard, I think, for everyone who takes a deep breath, looks around them, and tries to get their arms around this. Of course, I also worry very much that this will all discourage people from going to the voting booth in November. When people are angry and scared and confused, they may decide not to vote, and I'll just be partisan for a moment. Whatever you think is going on in the world or in this country, if anyone out there that's listening to your radio station thinks that having Donald Trump take this country over again is going to make things better, has no idea what's going on out there. And so I so worry that people will take all of this anger and confusion between each other. I don't think go and vote for Donald Trump, at least not here in New York. But if they don't go and vote, he wins anyway. So I am partisan. I am fundamentally a believer that a second presidential term of Donald Trump will be the end of democracy for all of us in this country. And don't even imagine what damage can be done internationally with one more of his administration.
Well, we are out of time. What a pleasure. We've been speaking with Senator Liz Krueger. She's a Democrat from the east side of Manhattan, the 28th district, and joins us from time to time on the Capitol Connection. I'm so pleased you spent the time going through the budget and all the important issues facing New Yorkers, and I can only hope that you'll come back again.
Thank you. Invite me, and if I can, I'll be happy to.
Thank you.
The Capitol Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capitol Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capitol Connection, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Capitol Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.